Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, in this case, the second part of my interview with death row inmate Kevin Cooper. I did part one last week. Kevin is very restricted as far as the ability to talk to people on the outside. I was in there for 5 hours, but couldn't really use the tape recorder. We're doing this by phone. Please bear with us. There are interruptions, but what Kevin has to say is a powerful statement of a man who I think is very much deserving of an innocence hearing and DNA testing. Kevin Cooper, welcome. Well, you know, I mean, just to recap for people, I mean, we're talking about a measure of justice in a case where the evidence has been, this is now the words of appellate court Judge William C. Fletcher, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he was speaking for almost half of the appellate court that was saying you should have these kind of hearings and so forth. He said the murders were horrible, we understand that, and Kevin Cooper is on death row because the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department framed him. This is not some wild claim of a supporter of yours. This is a guy who looked through all the evidence, sifted through it, trained judge. I just want to be clear here so people understand. This is a matter of evidence, the distortion of evidence, and the fact that we have scientific competence in reinvestigating these things. Because, for instance, the sweat under someone's arm, whether that shirt belonged to Kevin Cooper or it belonged to someone else, now can be determined with incredible precision that was not available before. And I should emphasize what these Brady violations are, and they've been well documented.
If I may add this, every time I turn around, we are discovering new evidence that not only proves my innocence, but proves that I was truly framed by the San Bernardino County. And this new evidence is not only compelling, all a person has to do is have common sense when they find out and read this stuff that we are telling the truth. Now, in the history in America, you have often had people, including judges, turn a blind eye to truth in order to have the person that they want murdered actually murdered. But whenever you have a judge forward and stands up and says, no, this person is innocent and this person was framed, you need to take that serious as a society, because judges don't often do that. That is not the rule. The rule is most judges turn a blind eye to truth on innocence because they are more concerned about procedure. In America, such thing in the Constitution about not executing an innocent person. If a person is innocent, but they had a quote-unquote fair trial, which seems like an oxymoron to me, then it's all right to execute them because it's about constitutional violations and all that when you get to federal court. This system is rigged. It's rigged against people like me. So if people out there don't give a damn, then this thing will never come to an end. And people end up being tortured, murdered physically by these people in here. But if society gives a damn, and they can shut these killing machines down all across this country, it's time to bring this madness to an end. Everybody thing is not fair. It can't be fair when the only people that get executed are poor people. It can't be fair when a person is more likely to get the death penalty if they're convicted, rightly or wrongly, of murdering white people than murdering any other skin color of a person. It's not fair. I mean, none of this is fair. It's not fair when the states can spend billions and millions and millions of dollars to get someone executed, but the defense is not giving that much try to save a person's life to prove them innocent. Public defenders don't get as much money to defend their client as district attorneys get to prosecute those people. This is not fair. This cannot be fair that the only people who can sit on drugs who are willing to impose a death penalty, those are the only people who can sit on a jury. It's not fair when a black man is the only black person in the courtroom when you got a white judge, a white district attorney, a white public defender, and an all-white jury. Justice, or that man that's justice, that's not fair, but that's America. I would like to see a white person sit in front of a black judge with a black prosecutor and an all-black jury and a black public defender, and I would wonder if they was going to get real justice. Or a Native American judge or a Native American prosecutor, public defender, and a Native American jury, and ask themselves, how do they feel? Do they feel like they're going to get real justice?
So let me just interrupt for a second, because people listening to this might say, okay, yeah, race is a factor, race is out there, but is that a cop-out here, or is it a cover-up? And I have to point out, this is not something Kevin Cooper is inventing for this case. The race has been built into it from day one. A terrible murder happened in San Bernardino County. A family got slaughtered, okay? And the survivor, the young son of this family, and he told the police, he told grandmas that three white guys did it. That's quote. They didn't say a black guy with dreadlocks or something. Now, there are suspects in this case. All that stuff about the bloody overalls and the bar and everything. There were three white guys in a bar with blood on them. That's part of the evidence that was withheld from the defense. So I don't want people to squiggle off the hook here and say, yeah, yeah, black guy bringing up the white, you know, race issue. The fact is, anyone looks at this case will see that it was informed by a racism from the first hour. The police, the sheriffs, had a horrendous murder on their hands in a rural, primarily white county of California, San Bernardino. And the first report from the surviving witness was, go find three white guys who did it. And instead, they find a black guy who'd walked off a prison farm. And he's going to be the guy. They're going to nail him. And they're going to quiet the crowd. They're going to save their political future. They're going to calm people. We got the killer. The DA of San Bernardino County, for the longest time, opposed any kind of testing of the DNA, any kind of look at the evidence. He was defeated by voters down there, in part because a very good law school professor wrote an article about his prejudice in this case. But the fact of the matter is, they had an institutional connection now with protecting their department. And it should be pointed out that sheriff's department had a lot of corruption in it. People who stole guns from the department thing and sold them out there. People who destroyed evidence. So we should talk about that. We're not talking about a bunch of saints in law enforcement.
Both call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Of this case, he was fired after my conviction for stealing around 5 pounds of heroin from the evidence room for his own personal use and the sale of drug dealers. So while he was working, he was a heroin addict. This is the same man who claimed to have found a bloody tennis shoe imprint on a bed sheet of the victims, not at the crime scene, but by folding two pieces of sheet together. And he had an exact same pair of shoes, tennis shoes, in his office that matched the print of blood on that sheet.
No, this is some of the stuff that Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times has led him to feel that there's been a miscarriage of justice here. And when you look at the people who, here's the judge said, a very important federal judge said, you were framed. Now, you're right, he wouldn't use that word without a great deal of consideration. That's a very serious charge for him to make. And the system will rally around not exposing it, because then, hey, what are we saying? We're saying that, what, the police can be corrupt? You got a case there in San Bernardino County, right, where the guy in the evidence room, he had guns that he sold. It wasn't just the drugs, right?
Sheriff himself That was the sheriff who stole all those guns. Over 500 guns. The sheriff, the then sheriff Floyd Kidwell, stole and gave away to other deputy sheriffs those guns that he stole.
And he got a slap on the wrist, right? He got
a slap on the wrist.
He got what? Exactly. A misdemeanor, but then they waived it. I mean, he didn't even do time.
He didn't. This good old boys club down there in San Bernardino General County. And again, I say this to your listeners. We, you and I, are not making any of this up. This is the truth about my case.
Kevin, I'm only here because I spent the last 2 years while my wife was writing what I assume will be a book about all this. I was looking at all this evidence. At first I thought, what is this all about and why are you spending all this time? And then I kept thinking, you know, wait a minute. This is so blatant, so obvious. Why hasn't anybody put a stop to it? That's the part I don't get, because we're not talking about Louisiana in the bad old days. We're talking about California, the deep blue state, you know?
If I may, I'd like to give out my website addresses so that people who really want to know more about this case can go and they can read Judge Fletcher's powerful and unprecedented page dissent on my case, in which those other 10 justices descended with him, and many other powerful things that vote and prove everything that you just said during this interview. And that website is
60 seconds remaining.
www.freekevincooper.org. And the media website where you can go find out who is all supporting me is www.org.
Can they get the Nick Kristof there too, on your site?
Yes, you can get everything on my website. Nick Kristof's piece about my case, even the link to my podcast that I did with Mr. Kristof. You can find that on my website at freekevincooper.org.
Okay, because I think people, if they just listen to some of that, they're going to be pretty unhappy with their own apathy. And let me just add, by the way, that we've been publishing Kevin Cooper on truthdig.com, and we have a pretty good site there with a lot of material on this case. So go to truthdig.com, look up Kevin Cooper. And I want to ask you, I mean, I've always wondered about how people keep sane under these situations. I remember when Nelson Mandela got out South Africa, I wondered, how did this guy survive being so clear and logical? And you know, I met you for 5 hours in San Quentin, and just today I was with the young lady Daniela, who a part of our leadership communications leadership program here at the Annenberg School at USC. We both talked today, and we talked about how, I don't know what the right word is, but there's a humanity that you've preserved. There's a humor, amazingly, a perspective. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of times you want to bang your head against the wall. We should talk a little bit about that. I mean, we didn't get to talk. You mentioned the books, for instance, that you've read. What's with these books? You wrote a whole piece for Truth Dig, but which books have really influenced you, and how has that helped you there in that cage?
Real quick, because I'm running out of time. That is this. Something happened, not just to Nelson Mandela, and not just to Malcolm X, and not just to me, and not just to a lot of other people in prison. They found out that they're fighting for something that is bigger than them. And when you find out through reading books, all different types of books.
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Types of books about the history of this country and the different struggles that have happened to different people, all poor, in this country, even poor white people, have been struggling in this country. And they still are struggling in this country. But yourself in a fight that is bigger than you, but yet it affects the lives of many people, and you can do something to help in that fight. You can't give up. You can't stop. You can't quit. as I was saying to you earlier, I did not choose this, to speak out against the death penalty. I didn't. This stuff chose me. I did not choose it. I was up here when I was in my early 20s, and the last thing I was about doing was this type of stuff. I was practicing escapism back there. I was going outside every day, playing basketball, working out, lifting weights, doing whatever I could not to pay attention to this stuff, because this is a depressing joint that I'm in, and it's a lot of negative, a lot of gangs, a lot of negativity that you wouldn't believe that runs amok up in this joint. So I was practicing escapism, but one day, some older brother, his name was Brother Marshall, he gave me a book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X. That's what he told me. And I read it. And then after I read that, I wanted to read more. I didn't even know I could read. I was told when I was growing up that I wasn't going to be nothing. I couldn't read because I never tried to read. But little by little, this movement, it got ingrained. I didn't get ingrained in it because I didn't even know it existed before I came here. And this is how, when you find yourself dialing out like this, you find the strength from your ancestors, from your spirituality, from your whatever it is, to keep going. And in the process of keep going, you find more like-minded people, whether on the outside where you are or the inside of here, who will help you to continue on. I mean, if I hadn't been in this movement, Mr. Robert Shear, I would not have met you. If I had not have been in this movement, I would have not met your wife. If I had not been in this movement, I would have never met the people from the grassroots movement called the Campaign and the Death Penalty, who helped get the Northern California Innocence Project, who in turn got the law firm of Orr, Harrington, and Sutcliffe involved in this case, which got me that stand execution in 2004. But I'm alive today because of this movement for our human rights, this movement against the death penalty. So I can't give up. I know no way but forward, and I will continue to go forward, just as Nelson Mandela did. Because Madiba, I love that man. He is true for all people, but especially for people. I've been blessed in the sixth sense of the word. I've been cursed by putting it here, but while I'm in here, I've been blessed, because there are a lot of death row inmates who commit suicide every time. They took a guy past his cage last night on the gurney because he went man down. Don't know why, but he had an oxygen mask on when they carried him by. Don't know if he lived or died, but they've been committing suicide up here. They've been killing each other up here. All types of craziness have been going on.
Let me ask you a question, though. Let's say when the... Because you're talking to me from your cage now, right?
Right.
What is it? You know, it's almost no room to walk, and you got that upside-down paint can to sit on. And you got the TV you've talked about is on some wire going
this
to some...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
Abnormal living. I don't know what's normal no more.
Now. Okay, but I mean, you're in this cage, and you get off the phone, and you get depressed, let's say. What could you do in terms of a book or something, or painting, or how do you get through the next hour, the hour after that? What do you do?
Or reading material is always at my disposal, and I've been lucky to do that. I listen to the radio. I listen to KPFA, Pacifica Radio. I always like what I stated in my column, that reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body, is something that I believe in. I must exercise my mind by reading different types of things. I want to read the same thing. I want to read different things, but it's all about...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Everything I read is about this fight that we're in, that I'm in, that poor people are in, that gays, lesbian, transgender people are in, bisexual people are in the same fight, no matter what our sexual orientation or our religion or whatever. If we're poor or we're considered different, we're deemed different by the powers that mean, and we're all in this struggle because they're trying to kill us one way or the other.
I heard a voice saying we're only at 60. We now have 30 seconds. Is that the final cut here, or are we going to...
I got to call back one more time.
Well, we'll use the interruption from the system as an occasion for a break, and be back with Kevin Cooper. We're back with Kevin Cooper after that break, and let's continue this discussion. You back on, Kevin?
I'm back on.
You know, it's interesting. People should know, I was in San Quentin with you for 5 hours in a cage... where they have people interview you and so forth. And there's a certain banality of evil. I mean, a guard will take our picture, or, you know, we can buy something from the canteen or something, and, you know, and you're handcuffed when you come in, and then you have to stick your hands back out. And they, and you say with the phone, what is it? They, you push the buttons, or where is the phone? Do you actually get to hold it, or?
The phone itself is outside this cage on a cart. The body of the phone with the receiver goes, the dial tone and the buttons and all that stuff is outside this cage on the cart. Now, I have the receiver in this cage because it has a cord that may be about four feet
I
long.
See. So you right. can't actually make
every
the call.
Time I hang up,
yeah.
Yeah. Every time I hang up, I got to put my hand outside, do the trace light, hang up, and then redial the button.
I got involved in your case really emotionally when I went to an exhibit at Columbia University with art from people in prison. And you had one piece that I thought was really powerful right at the front of this exhibit. And the artist said, well, that's the guy that I'm interested in his case and so forth. And now I got a painting you did of John Coltrane, which I think is very powerful. And I know your art is important to you. And I know I've been talking about maybe having an exhibit of your art here at USC where we're doing this recording and elsewhere. Tell me about the art and what it means and how you do it.
My art is a therapy. It helps me not just escape from this cage that I'm locked in by going inside that painting that I'm working on at that time. But it allows me to show my appreciation to the people who I do or the scenes that I paint, because I'm being deprived of so much that I find myself doing nature scenes just because nature is beautiful and everything in here seems to be ugly. So I use bright colors and different things. I knew how to draw when I first came here and paint a little bit, but mostly I learned from PBS stations that had art shows on there, like Bob Ross and different other artists who throughout the years have been shown on PBS shows. And I would pick up something here, something there. And so I found my own style because I didn't want to copy anybody. I wanted to be me. So it's just how I learned to express myself in a situation where expressing yourself was not, it helps me scream without making a noise. You know, it helps me say something without opening my mouth. So my artwork is the way I communicate with the outside world, I guess. And I like it like that. I like to produce. I guess I'm not just a consumer, I'm also a producer. So that makes me feel good, too.
And it's a way you can earn money, so you pay for your own meals.
Art buys and all that stuff, yeah.
But let me ask you, because that scream without making a noise, that's the picture that led the Columbia exhibit.
It's called Free Me. I was doing that to my attorney, Norman. That was his painting idea for him because I'm screaming to him to free me, to get me out of here. I've never been in here. I mean, I'm screaming for the free me, man. But that's the only way I could do it where he could hear me, but not hear me. If he hung it on a wall, what it says, because it's called Free Me, every time he looks at it, he hears me without hearing me.
Tell me about your attorney, because he would have been retired by now. He's put in a lot of time on this case, and he's the go-to guy in your defense, Norm Heil, right?
Yeah, and I've been very blessed as my attorney at Oort. In 2004, it was David Alexander, who was the attorney from Oort, that helped get me that stay of execution. But when David left Oort, Norman stepped in and took his place.
That's a kind of respectable law firm, right, in San Francisco and
right, or Harrington and Sutcliffe. They're not a criminal law firm. And that's something else about this criminal justice system. This white-collar law firm comes and takes my case away from an attorney, a criminal defense attorney, who damn near got me executed, and they use the same information that he had, and they get me a stay of execution. So that says something about this rotten-ass system. When they appoint attorneys to you who will get you murdered because they don't care, and you lucked up and got this law firm who did care, and they end up getting the estate. And Norman is part of that law firm, and he could have been retired like 10 years ago, but he said he was not retiring until he either got me out or I got executed. He believes he's going to get me out. So we just have to keep fighting. And I'm truly blessed to have a man like that who cares enough to not abandon me the way I've been abandoned in this place by so many other people. Thank God for Norman. And I don't thank God for many people.
Well, you know, I'm very impressed with Norm Hiles. So is my wife, Narda. And he's not one of these lawyers that you hear a lot about in terms of, you know, like the old William Kunstler, people like that.
Oh, and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And but, you know, in a very effective, quiet way, he has really opened up this case. And also, you got an ex-FBI agent helping you on this case, a guy who was second in command in the L.A. FBI office.
Yeah, Mr. Tom Parker, he's a former special FBI agent, and came, he saw my case, he read it. He said, man, this guy is innocent, and I'm going to get him. And that's what he's been doing for the last 8 or 9 years. And he's come up, a lot of this new evidence that we come up with, he's found it. A lot of new witnesses that we come up with, he's located them. I, again, have been blessed by people who, the outside of this California criminal justice system, have come in to this criminal justice system on a helping to expose the wrongs in my case that without them would not have been exposed, been dead a long time ago.
That's what, I just don't get it. I just don't get
it. Your call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I mean, how can you read that clemency petition? How can you look at what Norm Hiles compiled and what Tom Parker came up with? Nick Kristof in the New York Times wrote about. You look at all this stuff, and what you're only asking, I keep repeating this, but it should not be lost here, is more precise DNA testing using modern means, re-examination of the prospect of innocence, innocence hearing. And that's what they're resisting. I think that your case is a case study in the cynicism of this whole thing, you know, because what is the cost? Your defense is willing to pay for the testing. What is the cost? You know, why the rush to judgment? Why the rush to judgment in the face of new evidence?
There is a cost to be paid when we prove my innocence more so than we already have, because this criminal justice system will suffer for it.
Not if we're an enlightened society. It'll benefit, you know.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm just saying, who with a straight face would want to say, let's rush to judgment and kill someone for whom there's evidence showing innocence? That's what the Brady, people look up, who are listening to this, look up what a Brady violation is. That's what they're saying. They're saying six different times the authorities in this case down in San Bernardino County suppressed evidence, distorted evidence that would show a man who's on death row to be innocent. And then the other people, like in the governor's office, can ignore that, walk away from it. That's not right.
Okay. You don't care, man.
Well, the whole purpose of doing journalism is to get them to care, you know, is to make them care. That's why we're doing this interview, and I'm going to do my best to have them listen to it, others listen to it.
And I think in a little bit of time I got left, I would like to say this. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And I thank you for exposing the truth about my case. But this case is no different than a whole lot of other cases that people have the history of this death penalty. I mean, look what happened to Troy Davis in Georgia not too long ago. You know? I mean, there's cases like this all the time that come up. But the system is so hell-bent on killing us, they don't give a damn about innocence. It's about the system. It's about the process. It's about their justice.
30 seconds remaining.
Thank you very much. My peace out. Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. The prison authorities have told our time is over, and that's it. for part two of my interview with Kevin Cooper. We did part one last week, and both of them will be posted on KCRW and elsewhere. And let me just say something. I was in there for 5 hours. We could have done this interview in person, but we did it by phone. There are interruptions, but this is a minor part of what prison life is all about. And I think there's a compelling case. We've tried to make part of it here that everyone in prison deserves innocence hearings, deserves an examination of their case. But here on death row, because the voters of California have decided, in effect, to re-implement the death penalty to hasten the process, there's real urgency behind requesting an innocence hearing for Kevin Cooper, re-examination, retesting the DNA that was tampered with, and chemicals were used that show it was not the original test, and so forth. And I want to say to Kevin, I hope this goes well, and I do believe in your case, and I certainly believe in that people should listen to it. Our engineers are Kat Yore and Mario Diaz. Producers are Isabel Carrion and Josh Shear, and we'll see you next week. I do want to say I will do a part three if it's needed, but hopefully justice will be served, and Kevin can come out and do an interview in a studio at KCRW sometime in the near future. So take care, Kevin. Sacamos.